The science of climate change is clear. Put more gases in the atmosphere that act like a greenhouse, and you heat the planet up, forcing changes in the way the planet operates. We'll go beyond science today as we bring a philosopher in to talk about the issue and our responsibilities as denizens of the planet. Kathleen Dean Moore's latest book is Great Tide Rising, Towards Clarity and Moral Courage in a Time of Planetary Change. Kathleen Dean Moore taught critical thinking and environmental ethics in her tenure as a philosophy professor at Oregon State University, with a focus on the role of humans in the natural world. Her essays have been widely published in a variety of media and in anthologies. Kathleen co-founded and for many years directed the Spring Creek Project for Ideas, Nature, and the Written Word. She now serves as a senior fellow there. And she visited the Exchange in 2010 to talk about a previous book of many essays she co-edited, and that was called Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. Kathleen Dean Moore, thanks for coming back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, it's nice to be here, Jeff. Thanks.
Sure. It's clear you feel a sense of urgency about climate change. Are you dismayed that more people do not at this point in history?
Well, I am. I do feel urgency. We are at a hinge point in history. I believe you could drive a nail through this decade and the future of the world would swing in the balance. It astonishes me that people aren't gathering on the street corners to talk in hushed voices about the future, keeping their voices low so the children don't hear. It is that urgent.
Well, and in terms of talking about the children, you open your portion of the book with a vignette about being on the beach with your grandchild, and the word catastrophe appears by the sixth paragraph, specifically about sea stars wasting. But this is just one of many things you've noticed just in your own experience that look different.
Yeah, you know, there's a group of scientists led by, 500 of them led by a team from Stanford, and they said that unless we take immediate action, by the dime today's children are middle-aged, the life support systems of the world will be irretrievably damaged. And so as I'm standing on the beach looking at these decimated starfish with this little four-year-old kid in a yellow slicker, it's very clear to me that we need to take some action. Just imagine, life support systems irretrievably damaged by the time the children are middle-aged.
Is there any doubt in your mind as you look at things like sea star wasting disease, you know, and somebody could come along and tell us that it's this virus or that pathogen, but that it's all interconnected with the general trend of things on the planet?
Yes, there's some reason to think that the warming of the oceans have empowered the viruses that are causing the wasted disease. But on a larger scale, you're right. You know, solving these problems, even understanding them, is this huge exercise in connecting the dots and understanding this deep interdependence of all the systems on Earth.
There's the argument, and you take note of this in the book, in Great Tide Rising, that we can invent our way out of the dangers we face, that we can come up with better gadgets or something, but you suggest that we need to reinvent a few other things too.
Right. I think that there are three steps that we need to take in meeting this crisis. The first one is to stop the harm, to stand in the way of the pipelines and the oil rigs, and to say not another river, you know, not another mountain range, not another plateau can be sold. These don't belong to the corporate powers. These belong to the everlasting Earth. So the first step is to stop the harm. The second step, I think, is to find a better way. You know, there's this wisdom that if we find a better way, then the world will turn to it. But the third, as you say, has to do with taking the opportunity offered by this crisis to think again about who we are, we human beings, we soft little things scurrying around this planet, and to renounce this notion that we are the reason for the world, that we are the great kings of all creation, that we can control this world to our own ends, and understand ourselves as beings who are knit into this web of life, intricately interdependent, and certainly not in control.
So not the old nature was put here for humankind to maintain dominion over.
Yeah, dominion, which we have translated rather nastily as pillage and plunder, and use up in what has become this great going out of business sale.
So as you point out, there's really morality at the center of this, or a lack of it, the way we perhaps have been acting. But you seem to reject the idea that we shouldn't be emotional about this.
Oh, no. I mean, this crisis is too big for us to use only one part of our abilities. So we need to summon everything we've got, heart and mind. And so I take great pains in this book to weave, in some sense, personal experience, the personal essay that people know me for, with this more philosophical analysis, so that with ideas and experience, all of our resources, our ability to analyze, right, and to reason and to argue and to infer, but also our ability to grieve and to celebrate and to hope, to despair, and to imagine. That's the big one, imagine.
I just realized that all the analogies I was trying to come up with involve combustion. I was going to say we need to be firing on all cylinders or cooking on all burners, but then we're talking about fuel consumption here, aren't we?
We need to fly on new wings. How's that?
Very good, very good. Yeah, there's a vignette in here with your neighbor who suggests appealing to people's fears to get them to act. How did that strike you when you heard it?
Well, appealing to their fears and also appealing to their greed. pardon me. I think it's a misreading of history, the claim that he was making. He was saying that the great changes in history have not come about because of any ethics. Ethics has no power. What has caused change is economics, people's fear, and their sense of greed. And I think that's just not true. I mean, when you look at the history of the United States, for example, every change that has been huge and quick, I might say, has been caused by a rising wave of affirmation of a great moral principle. So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And these European monarchies just toppled like dominoes. Or it's wrong to hold people in slavery, and henceforth, no people shall be held as slavery in these United States. And although it took a war and a great deal of suffering, in the end, the history changed its course.
All right.
Or I have a dream, and these growling dogs in the fire hoses stumbled back, so hell no, I won't go. In these cases, it's been moral affirmation, highly charged affirmation of a moral principle that has changed history.
Much more to talk about with Kathleen Dean Moore. Her book is Great Tide Rising. We'll come back and talk more with her thoughts on a more moral component of working to defeat climate change when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kathleen Dean Moore, the well-known Oregon philosopher, late of Oregon State University. She's written a book about climate change called Great Tide Rising, Towards Clarity and Moral Courage in a Time of Planetary Change. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this issue and the moral component of it. We go beyond the scientific now to talk about responsibilities as human beings and as living creatures on the planet Earth. 800-838-3760 is the phone number to join this conversation. Joined by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Kathleen, I want to come back a step because you were talking about the American Revolution and ending tyranny from Europe, about ending slavery and the civil rights struggle. In the first two cases, there were wars. You acknowledge that much. And in the third case, a fair number of people died for that cause as well. Are you concerned it's going to get to that point where people have to die for the message to get across about climate change?
I hope not. But I also would point out that people already are dying because of climate change. I mean, dying in huge numbers, and that plants and animals are dying as well. Since 1970, the world has lost 40% of the plants and animals that used to be here. So the death has begun. You think about the climate refugees. You think about people who are being driven from their homes by storms. The dying has become real. Whether it means dying in protest, I desperately hope not.
So the rising tide you speak of, certainly it could be taken by some people to mean the rising oceans, but it's really a tide of moral affirmation, as you point out, versus moral prohibition. Can you tease those apart for us, moral affirmation and moral prohibition?
Yeah, we have two ways of looking at what we ought to do. The first, the ethic of prohibition, is this idea that thou shalt not, and if you do, then you are a bad person. That gets tiresome in a big hurry. What we're looking for now, I think, is an ethic of affirmation, where we're clear about what is good, where we're clear about what we aspire to, and where we aim towards things that are better rather than squeaking through right on the very edge of worse. So a national discourse about what is a good corporation? What is a good life? What is worthy of us as human beings? That sort of discourse, it's a moral discourse of affirmation, I think can lead us in better directions than these narrow prohibitions on killing off almost endangered species or things like that.
Do we ever get to those big conversations? I mean, for the number of times I've heard we need to have a great national conversation about this, we don't seem to have conversations so much as letting events shape things for us. Are you concerned that that's where we're heading with this, too?
Well, I would call on the great institutions of valuing. You know, we have them. They are universities, they are churches, they are families, they are political discourse, where we talk about what we care about more than anything else. Can we enlist the power of those institutions to create this conversation? I think that's a real call, and that to the extent that these institutions are falling short of that, I think that's very much not to their credit.
Let's take a phone call here. We have Kara and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathleen Dean Moore, the author of Great Tide Rising.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
Well, today, this evening, the Amazon Neighbors Association, I'm part of that, we're having an event around climate change that we call Celebrate and Love Our Planet Earth. And we're just going to have eat cookies, make Valentine's, learn about climate change a little bit, and we're going to brainstorm a little bit about what we'd like to do at our neighborhood level, and it's going to be like a whiteboard. So, Kathleen, if you were at our meeting, what would you put on the whiteboard for what you'd like to do at your neighborhood level together with neighbors?
All right. Thanks for the question, Kara.
It's a good one, and aren't those whiteboards something? They seem to stir us towards actions. I think that that one of the things I would put on the top is get my own house in order, make sure that everyone there has fully divested from fossil fuels, that they're not gaining in their own private budgets from the destruction of the earth and the damage to their own children. I would say, first of all, get your house in order. Then I would say, second of all, create a sanctuary wherever you can, and find places where you can plant native grasses and tear out concrete and make a place for life in your neighborhood. I would say form yourself up into a powerful political force to make sure that there is no new infrastructure for fossil fuel economy growing up into that area in Eugene. Oh, there's so many things that one can do. The thing that I would urge is that it go beyond recycling, that it go beyond light bulbs. These are the things we already should have done, and of course we all need to do that. But we need to reimagine a place, and we have to reimagine how we live in that place, particularly in terms of what we offer the children. So thanks, Kara. That's fantastic.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Kara. It's been a long time. The idea then of reimagining the planet and you, the little piece that you gave there about tearing up concrete and planting places again. Are you saying we need to renaturalize the planet?
Well, the fact about plants is that they soak up carbon dioxide, and that when people talk about, quote, saving the earth, quote, one of the things that has to happen is for us to have this huge reforestation effort. If it breathes, it should be allowed to live. And of course, we have breathing grasslands and forests and so forth. So yeah, renaturalizing in some way, making the world back into the carbon sink that it could possibly be. Yeah, I think so.
So the first section of Great Tide Rising is called It's Wrong to Wreck the World. And the first chapter in that section is called Why It's Wrong. Was there any, I don't know, giggling to yourself or something, thinking that you have to explain why it's wrong to wreck the planet?
You know, when I say that phrase, people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because they do think it's self-evident that it's wrong. But then maybe it's because they're uncomfortable with the way in which we completely permit that to be happening. We see people wrecking the world. We see our own selves wrecking the world. And I think people do titter a little bit, and it makes them squirm to actually say those words. It's wrong to wreck the world.
And you end up with 13 reasons why it's wrong. Is there a best reason or a best pair of reasons to motivate all of us not to wreck the earth?
Well, there are three that speak most strongly to me, and perhaps they will to your audience as well. The first reason it's wrong to wreck the world is that it's a betrayal of the children. They didn't bring this on themselves. They don't deserve what's barreling at them down the pike. They are the epitome of innocent and blameless, and yet they're the ones who are going to be struggling to live in a world with northern spreading diseases and wide migrations of desperate, starving people, collapse of the oceans and agriculture. They didn't deserve that. And if we love them, why aren't we expending every ounce of our energy to preserve a world that would nourish them? So that's one. The second, I think, is that climate change is a social injustice. It's an outrage against innocent people. That all around the world, people are finding that their lifeways are being destroyed. In Africa already, now we have Zimbabwe with a declaration of emergency because of drought. We have declarations of emergency in California. People are suffering, and they're suffering unjustly because they're not the ones who are getting the benefit of this profligate use of energy. They're the ones who are suffering the consequences. And the third reason, I think, is that if we fail in stopping climate change, it will be a failure of reverence for the natural world. It's a glorious place out there. There is so much of value and so much worth saving. The astonishing world, the astonishing oceans, and the damage that is happening to them is simply a desecration of this gift of the world. So those three speak most powerfully to me, although there are 10 more we could go into.
Right. Okay. Kathleen Dean Moore is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Great Tide Rising, Towards Clarity and Moral Courage in the Time of Planetary Change. Kathleen spent many years at Oregon State University as a philosophy professor and has put together quite a few works over the years. She joined us several years ago to talk about moral ground, ethical action for a planet in peril. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about climate change and moral parts of that whole equation. 800-838-3760 on the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. As you move into the reasons that work for you, Kathleen, you tell us a story of Wonder Bread. What is that?
I was over at the coast, and here comes this white Buick, and it was trailed by a flock of gulls. And a woman gets out, and she opens her trunk, and it is crammed with white bread, Wonder Bread. And she starts throwing it to the gulls. Well, I know that that's a terrible thing to do to a gull, and that it causes deformity in their wings to feed them bread and so forth. But the storm of wings, the storm of whiteness, the urging toward life, the great gluttony for what is living was so impressive to me that I joined her in these clouds of birds, and it was one of those moments where you think, what an extraordinary, astounding world, astounding from the same word as thunder, tonus, astounding, like being struck by lightning, the sense of the wonder of the world, radical astonishment. And I thought, this attitude towards life, this great respect and joy in what's here, may be the foundation for our action, if we honestly feel it with our whole selves.
There's such a sharp distinction you make in this section of the book between the wonders of the world and the way that we can just stare at things dripping for hours because they are just that entrancing to look at, and the distinction between that and our fright at the fate of the planet. It really is a sharp distinction.
Yeah, the new polling is showing that people who are concerned about climate change are overwhelmingly in despair, overwhelmingly frightened. We're talking of 60, 70, 75% of people are disgusted and dismayed. Yes, I think that people feel that we've stalled in some ways on climate change, and that the consequences are just going to be tragic beyond imagining.
You discuss the idea of instrumental value and intrinsic value, and this is in people and planets, whatever. Can you give us a sense of what that's about?
Yeah, that distinction, I think, comes from many places, but Immanuel Kant, a German philosopher, he says that there are two kinds of value. Instrumental value is the value, its usefulness to us. So a shovel, for example, has instrumental value because you can use it to dig. Intrinsic value is quite different. It's the value something has in and of itself apart from its usefulness to us. So I give the example of my husband, who has great instrumental value. He's very handy. He's wonderful. help. He's a good cook. He does all these things for me. He has instrumental value for me. But at the same time, he has intrinsic value. He's valuable in himself. He is worthy of existing apart from his usefulness. And the point I wanted to make with that was to say that, yes, this world is huge instrumental value to us. Honestly, it feeds us. It nourishes us. It gives us to drink. But it also has intrinsic value. That is to say, apart from its usefulness, even if there were no people here to be served by it, it would have a value. It's better that it exists than it not. It's worthy.
Is your concern, though, that too many people see just the instrumental value? You know, what can I get out of the earth? What can I dig up, cut down, you know, drill for, et cetera?
Yeah, and the thing is, if you're going to consider only the instrumental value of the earth, then you better be careful how you use it, because it can very easily turn on you, and that's the case, isn't it? That's ironic. It's an absolute irony that as we use the planet, we use it up and we destroy its usefulness, even as we suck the usefulness to our purposes.
You imagine a conversation in the book with your granddaughter at the point where she is raising her own child, wondering why this generation didn't stop wrecking the planet, which got me to a point of wondering how easy it is for people to say, well, it wasn't me. I did the best I could do.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, we have to be clear about that, too, because all of us are contributing. All of us are contributing to the warming of the earth. But it's the extractive industries, it's the oil and the gas companies who are the major contributors and who are making it so very, very difficult for us to find alternative ways to heat our homes and get around. So I wouldn't give a pass. I worry when people blame themselves and by that means give a pass to these corporations whose business plans, in order to increase their profits, are designed to wreck the world, to pillage and destroy the systems that sustain us.
Kathleen Dean Moore, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is Great Tide Rising. I wonder what to make of what's going on with fossil fuels at this very moment in history. I was hearing this morning that the price of gasoline could easily stay under $2 a gallon for this entire calendar year, which would be the first year like that in a very, very long time, I'm thinking. But people's behaviors do tend to hinge on things like what gasoline costs at the pump and that sort of thing. Is it hard to get them to focus on a real broader view of life and the world when you've got a situation like that going on where their pocketbooks are immediately affected?
Yes, I don't understand what's going on with the price of oil either. It certainly has far-reaching consequences. Yes, it's hard until you sit down with people, and this is one of the things that I do as I travel around with this book, is say, what is it that you love? What is most important to you? And the price of gas doesn't come up. Family comes up. Health comes up. Connection to something bigger than they are, to some natural world or some sacred world. These are the things that people think about when you really ask them to sit down and think about what they care about more than anything else. So it's a matter of conscious attention, I think, to our values and how they shape our decisions.
And while we're talking about fossil fuels, there's a story in here about you flying over the Bakken oil field on a red-eye flight. What did you see?
Oh, it was midnight. And the pilot came on, and he said, look out the left side of the plane. Those are the Bakken fracking fields. And from horizon to horizon, we're at 35,000 feet. From horizon to horizon, that land was studded with flame. It was as if, you know, those cemeteries in Europe where those crosses just stretch forever? It was as if they'd burst into flame, that regular, in rows and rows and rows of flame. I thought, my God, how could people ever do that to the earth?
And it was just flaring off the methane that comes with the oil drilling?
Yeah, it was spectacular.
Wow, spectacular and frightening at the same time. All
exactly
at once.
Right. Yeah.
As you get into saying that the, as we talk about saving the planet because we believe in human rights, is that something that gets a bit abstract for people?
Does it get abstract? Well, perhaps because of the, you know, just some sort of free, I don't know why, scientists could tell you, the worst effects of climate change are being felt by people who are distant from us in parts of the country that we don't often, parts of the world that we don't often see. So when we think about the disappearance of glaciers from the Tibetan plateau and the effect that's going to have on, what, a seventh of the world's population when those rivers die up, it's hard for us to think about that here in this beautiful, well-watered Oregon. That's one of the problems with climate change, is that it is happening now. The consequence, of course, will spread around the world, but it's happening now in places that we can't see. And it's taking place in terms of disappearances. And, of course, it's hard to see disappearance. It's hard to see when plants and animals and birds disappear. It's hard to see when people move out of a place. And we all know that the consequences are going to be in the future, and that perhaps we could escape them. So it's a tough problem.
It is indeed. And we'll talk more with Kathleen D. Moore about Great Tide Rising, Towards Clarity and Moral Courage in a Time of Planetary Change. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take more of your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Kathleen D. Moore and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to the philosopher Kathleen D. Moore, late of Oregon State University. She's written a book about climate change and our responsibilities. It goes way beyond the science and often to how we as creatures interact with the planet and each other and our responsibilities within those realms. Great Tide Rising is the name of the book, subtitled Towards Clarity and Moral Courage in a Time of Planetary Change. The phone number to join this conversation, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Kathleen, I always come back to, and it was part of where I was going to with the idea of trying to take care of human rights in a world, at least in the West, where people tend to be thinking about themselves first. Often it seems like people are trying to push the old Adam Smith idea on us, the invisible hand, where we're working for self-motivated reasons but producing potentially a greater good. I mean, is there a way we can still work with ourselves and achieve a greater good to forestall or reverse climate change?
Half of me thinks that that climate change is the final refutation of Adam Smith's invisible hand. That people acting selfishly in a world that is finite, people accumulating for themselves in a world that has limits, has brought us to this total refutation of the fact that that could lead to the common good. The other half of me says, you know, if people really understood their own self-interest, if people really were careful about what their decisions were going to do to them, and if they understood the science of climate change, then they would be the biggest climate hawks around, because, of course, the consequences of climate change are going to come back to bite us, all of us.
Another call here from John in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathleen Dean Moore. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. I'll try to develop this as fast as I can. This is relating to energy waste and so forth, and the stuff that's right under our nose, but we can't see it. And, you know, it's easy to see these cars sitting on the highway and so much waste and trips that don't need to be taken. But one thing that's got me lately has been alternative energy systems and people talking about the grid, and they're so excited to be plugging their car into the grid and so forth like this, you know. But what's happening is the grid is the most wasteful thing that's ever been invented. It's never going to change. There's a 30 to 40% loss in it. Just always will be that way, just because of physics. So what bothers me is that we're in the alternative energy community, we're encouraging people to mimic the grid and embrace the grid and worship the grid, when really this is one of our biggest problems. And one of the biggest parts of it is the psychological part that the grid gives us. It gives us this idea of an umbilical cord from infinity that oh, you know, I can waste energy because it's out there. You know, it's in the grid. You know, everybody will take it up. And then so you have alternative energy people, and this is where it gets into the poverty situation, because poor folks are paying taxes to subsidize and underwrite subsidies to folks that can't afford to pull the trigger on a big grid system, and the grid system being built into the grid and encouraging this the waste of the grid in an alternative way, and it's being projected into the future in this manner, mm-hmm. and nobody's talking about that. And the psychology of the grid is horrific, and we'll never get rid of that as long as we keep plugging into it.
All right, let's take that up with Kathleen. Appreciate that, John. So, Kathleen, it kind of reminds me of a conversation I had about landfills many years ago with a Wisconsin state legislator who said there's no such place as away, and yet we throw our things away, and we get our power from away. Way away from us. Is that part of our issue, you think, as humans?
Yeah,
is that everything
yeah.
comes and goes someplace else?
Well, and I think that the caller was quite right in raising actually a larger point, and that is that we are really scrambling to find ways to preserve this way of life. We're trying to look for alternative technologies so that we can continue to do things as we have already done them, which is wastefully, profligately, and the struggle to save our way of life, whereas actually this way of life is what is the problem, and that our work is not to do that, but to save our way of life, to save the world from our way of life, is what I'm trying to say, is to save this sustaining world from life ways that are destructive, even if they have these new technologies. So I was very disturbed in Paris when right before people were to get together to reimagine how we might live on Earth, that here comes Bill Gates and his millionaire friends, and he says, I'm going to put all this money and partner with the government so that we can find technological fixes to these great problems and make money at the same time. And I thought that was a subversion of what was supposed to happen in Paris. What was supposed to happen in Paris, where people were supposed to find new ways to leapfrog the old ways, and they weren't going to be technological. They were going to be deep changes in culture.
So we're not just talking in your mind about taking the lifestyle we have and finding a new outlet in which to plug it, but changing
exactly.
the lifestyle itself.
Nicely said. Yes, yes, that is exactly right.
So, I mean, when you think about just sort of the day-to-day nuts and bolts kind of lifestyle changes we'd have to make, what do you see?
Well, you know, when I talk to climate activists, they are great travelers, and that's one of the things that we have to learn to do, is to be happier at home. Travel is a huge cost to the planet. We're going to have fewer children or none at all. Population is a huge cost to the planet. We're going to have to think about pleasures that don't come in plastic and a variety of different colors, pleasures that have to do with contact with other people, with family, with contact with the natural world. All these things and many, many more.
Let's take another call. We have Lucretia and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathleen Dean Moore.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very concerned about all the tree death. There's probably half of our beautiful trees in Ashland are dying. You can see they're getting mold, and there's fungus, and they're falling over at the base, and they're just then the bark beetle comes in. And I'm very concerned because I understand our military pollutes more than all six other huge military, you know, big military powers combined. And so they are the about three-fourths of all the pollution come out of there. But then they also run the geoengineering project, or what is now listed as an exotic weapon, by the government itself in the 1990 manual that they basically list chemtrails in the Department of Defense in 1990 as a title to the chemistry manual for future Air Force pilots.
Okay, I'm going to get off chemtrails, contrails, whatever we want to call them, and get back to the larger subject of pollution by the military. Kathleen, can you comment on that?
Well, let's talk about trees. I'm horrified by what she says about the trees down in Ashland, but you can add that to what we're hearing about the death of trees across the expanse of Texas, about the death of trees in the Cascade Mountains here, across the death of trees across Canada, the oh, and then the rainforest, it's a problem, terrible problem, because of the loss of the trees themselves and the habitat they provide. But it's even worse problem because they're the carbon sink. It's the trees that can help absorb some of that carbon dioxide and store it for us. So that's and the forest fires that are burning into the dead in the dead forest, it is enough to make a person tear her hair. The notion that the one thing that we need, one of many, but one thing that we need are healthy forests. And it's exactly that we're losing at such a rate.
When I think about the people who cut down trees in the Amazon rainforest, for example, to make room for cattle ranches and anybody else who gets involved in a process where they're changing things dramatically, potentially for the entire planet. I'm just reminded of a phrase, and I'm probably going to botch it a bit, but the idea that a person will not understand you if their livelihood depends on them not understanding you. And then I think about, so do people trash the planet because it's lack of knowledge or lack of caring, or because they care about something like they can become rich selling ivory, even though it involves killing off all the elephants?
Or are they in a desperate situation where they see very, very few alternatives apart from those that are destructive to? I'm not going to be throwing blame in the direction there, conscious of the fact that we are basically exporting our despoiling of the earth, and that our demand for consumer goods here in the United States and food and so forth, meat, and in the cities is exporting the practices that would ruin the earth. So yeah, I think we have a very definitely a desperate situation. And I'm glad you raised that point about how we can't understand something that would hurt our livelihood. I think that's exactly right.
Myra in Ashland emails, what about pollution from animals? The meat industry is a huge contributor to climate change, yet no one seems to want to address it. I mean, cows make methane, we know that much, and methane's an actually worse greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
I think she's absolutely right. I think they also make mud. They also, I don't think people should be eating beef, that's for sure. I don't think they should be eating pork. I don't think people should be... Well, for what it does to their bodies, but also for what it does to the planet. I think there's no question about that.
So turning to the idea of an ethic of the earth, Aldo Leopold, who was a great conservationist in the early 20th century, had some thoughts about how ethics evolve that you walk us through in the book. Can you give us a taste of that?
He says that that the history of the moral development of the human being is a history of the expansion of the sphere of their moral concern. In other words, at the early stages of humanness, we felt a moral obligation and felt moral value in our family and then our tribe, and that over time that sphere of concern has increased to include finally people of all races and then women and then certain kinds of animals and plants and now perhaps even more, until one presumes that as we become even more fully developed as human beings, we will understand that the sphere of our moral concern includes the land, he says, and the air and the water. He was quite an interesting man, both a scientist and a philosopher and a writer.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We have another call here. Let's go to Al in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathleen Dean Moore. Al, you there?
Yes, yeah, I am. I was listening to the call, and I feel very strongly that chemtrails are causing most of the...
Gotta go. Not going to do chemtrails and contrails. Not now, not ever. Sorry. Kathleen, let's move on to the discussion about the ethics of the cosmos that we move on from Aldo Leopold and the ethic of the Earth. Can you explain what the thinking is there?
There are wonderful stories that we're learning more and more about the origin of the universe and the origin of the planet. And as we become aware of the process, this incredible unfolding, unfurling of the creative urgency of the universe to create planets, water, finally life, you get the sense that you are part, that we all are, and in fact are, part of this journey of the universe. The creative, we are the creative flowering of the universe. And when we think of ourselves that way, when we think of ourselves as built into the creative processes of the universe, then we feel a little, then we can understand our role somewhat differently. We are not the lords of creation, but we are participating in this journey of the universe that is astounding, glorious, and that as we think about how we live, our focus should be on how we can become part of the unfolding, how we can be nourishing the creativity of the universe instead of snuffing it out.
So, it's most provocative in the book when you talk about the idea of how the future will view this time. And you mentioned earlier that this is potentially the nail upon which history hinges. And it sounds like we're really at a critical moment, if we're not past it already, where we need to do something.
Yeah, we will. Probably before our deaths, we will live in a different world. And whether it's a world of possibility and imagination and a true excitement of finally figuring out how we can live in concert with all life, or whether it's this rapid ruin of the systems that sustain us, that's a human decision. That's a decision that we collectively are going to make. And the responsibility that falls on us, you and I and everyone who's listening, how terrible a responsibility that is. It's not a responsibility I would have chosen. But here we are, the ones who are going to have to make this great turning towards something sustainable or witness its fraying.
Are we good at that as humans, making these big paradigm shifts?
We have. We've done it many, many times. And you say a paradigm shift, and you're exactly right. There comes a point in time when one story about who we are meets up with reality, and at that point, everything changes.
We will see where things go. Much more to talk about down the road, but we're done with today. Great Tide Rising is the name of Kathleen Dean Moore's book. Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
A pleasure, Jeff. Thank you so much.
All right, take care.